Paranormal. Para X. The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Hey, Merry Meet everybody, and welcome to a slightly different Stirring the Cauldron show tonight. My guest is author and lecturer Nicholas Pearson, and he's been involved with all aspects of the mineral kingdom for more than a couple of decades and studied mineral science at Stetson University, worked for several years at the Gillespie Museum, which is home to the largest mineral collection in the southern United States, and says that stones and crystals are our most ancient teachers. Now, every time Nicholas comes on in the past, we generally talked about his books or, you know, a specific topic like crystal skulls, for example. But he's one of those guests who gets totally bombarded by questions from the chat room, and we never get most of them answered because we run out of time. So I got to thinking that perhaps I needed to dedicate a whole show with Nicholas just answering listeners' questions. And we've got several questions that were lined up, submitted during the week, but we're also going to take live questions from the chat room. And so if anybody is listening live and has a question or comment for Nicholas, please join us at paraxradionetwork.com. And I think we've got to get started or we'll run out of time again, Nicholas, and that's not a good thing. Going to change all the things that I just said. So I think this is going to be fun. I think it's going to be fun. I think it's going to be interesting. And I think it's informative also. And thanks for agreeing to be having your brain picked and being the first guinea pig for this type of show for the entire hour.
Well, it is my pleasure. And thank you, as always, for having me back.
No, that's my pleasure, that part of it. All right. So let's just jump into a couple of questions here. The first two questions that came in were kind of a little bit about Crystals 101, as I call it. The first question is, what is the best way to cleanse crystals?
Oh, this is a great one. So, you know, when it comes to cleansing crystals, you're going to have some stones that are maybe more sensitive than others and are going to require a little bit of special care. So there are tons of ways you can cleanse them in sunlight and moonlight and water and salt. You can bury them in the earth. You can, you know, perch them in some greenery. You can use the breath or smoke from your favorite cleansing herb. But some stones are kind of finicky. So some can bleach in the sun or be damaged by water or salt or other methods. So my three favorite ways that are safe for all crystals and give you an effective cleansing experience are breath, sound, and smoke. And obviously, you know, the different methods are going to appeal to different lifestyles, different situations. We don't always have a bundle of sage or some frankincense and marina charcoal in our pocket. We might not always have a beautiful gong or Tibetan singing bowl, but we always have our breath. So I think the breath is a really great way to cleanse. It's one of the techniques that I teach in several of my books, as well as in a lot of my live classes. You can certainly find that in Crystal Basics, but it is a great way when we breathe with intention. We can make magic happen with our stones.
And so simply, you know, people think it's going to be a big deal. We've got to wait for a full moon or, you know, we got to have sea salt or something. And I mean, you make it sound so easy and it actually is. It shouldn't be difficult anyway.
For sure.
Yeah. All right. So the second part of that question is, how often should I do it? How often should I clean my crystals?
You know, most of the time when I get asked this, my answer is, you should cleanse them more often than you already are. You know, we love the full moon. Witches love the full moon. People love the full moon. It's a great thing. But imagine if you only changed your socks and underwear once a month when the moon was full. That's kind of what it's like when you only cleanse your crystals once a month under the light of the full moon. Certainly take advantage of the moon when you've got it, but you know, do this often. You wash your hands several times a day, I'm hoping. You should cleanse your crystals, maybe not several times a day, although there might be a reason to. So cleanse them as often as you can. I like to do it before and after any like particular or specific use. I also cleanse them overnight when I get home. I empty out my pockets. I take off my bracelets or my pendant or beads or whatever it is I've got. And I let it cleanse overnight before I pick it up again the next day.
Mm-hmm. Now, some people are confusing or have confused the difference between charging a stone and cleansing a stone. Is there a difference? And if so, what would it be?
Yeah, so there is a big difference here. You know, we see a lot of those memes on the internet, like, sorry, can't do that, got to charge my crystals. But I think a lot of us maybe use the words charge and cleanse to describe a similar process without really giving thought to what's happening here. As far as charging your crystals, they are not batteries that get depleted. They're not like your mobile device that you got to plug in or it's going to die on you. That's not how the physics of crystal energy works. The idea of charging a stone actually comes from a much older tradition of charging magical ingredients or charging spiritual tools. And in this sense, the word charge doesn't mean to fill up with energy. Instead, it is the same as like to carry out a charge, to be given a specific task or a specific duty that must be fulfilled. So you can be charged with the task of, you know, standing watch or promoting peace or whatever it might be if you're a stone. But you don't necessarily get filled up with a particular vibe during that charging process. So charging is wonderful. I think if we look at charging in this context, it's what we might call programming or, you know, inspiring or, you know, imbuing with an intention. And it's not a replacement for cleansing. So, you know, charging is not something we do with moonlight, or charging is not something we do with water. Those are cleansing. And truth be told, they're both equally important parts of the process. If you try to imbue something or program something with an intention, but it is not thoroughly cleansed, there's not going to be enough room inside the crystal, so to speak, to hold on to that new intention. So you got to cleanse it. And a cleansed crystal will do its job beautifully. But if you also program it with the specific focus you'd like to work on, then you're going to get it to hone in on that one specific task.
Mm. You know, it's funny how things come up, because the next question was one that you submitted, that people submitted to you, and it had to do with selenite. Does selenite need to be cleansed? And then just as I'm pulling that up, Swampy in the chat room writes, I charge and cleanse my crystals with selenite and moon water. So, yeah. You know, talk about, wow, yeah.
Sure. So, more than a couple decades ago, we'll say, there was an author who published a book called Love is in the Earth. Her name is Melody. Melody passed away end of last year, beginning of this year, right around New Year's Eve. And her first book went into a second edition that was updated and greatly expanded. But in that second edition, she describes two stones that in her experience never needed cleansing or clearing. And they were natural citrine, you know, the real stuff, as well as kyanite. And her experience was the pieces she had just never seemed to hold on to negativity. Mm. But, you know, the thing about cleansing is that it is not necessarily removing negativity or disharmony. Cleansing is something we do to wipe the slate clean so there's space for us to focus on one particular thing. One of the natural functions of anything that has a crystal lattice, anything that's remotely crystalline, whether it is a beautiful piece of quartz or selenite or kyanite or the gypsum crystals in our wall or the phospholipids in our cell membranes that make up our body, crystals have memory. So they are constantly recording everything they're coming into contact with as far as electromagnetic energy goes. And, you know, eventually they're so full of all those experiences, there's no room for something new. So we cleanse all of our crystals because we need to kind of wipe the slate clean to be able to have our specific intention or focus when we do the work we're doing. So, you know, as far as my experience goes, as far as the physics that describe how crystal energy can work, all crystals require cleansing and clearing. Certainly some have a faster metabolism than others, maybe mm-hmm. some like selenite. But, you know, imagine you use selenite to cleanse your favorite piece of quartz, but then you never cleanse your selenite. That's a lot like using a sponge to wash your dishes, but never cleaning your sponge. Mm-hmm. After a while, your dishes aren't clean anymore.
Good analogy. And I think, you know, people might not understand that sometimes you can make, you can use selenite, the stone, in moon water to make a cleansing bath for the crystals, right? I mean, you can make all kinds of things with stones in certain types of water.
You certainly could. You know, some forms of selenite are really, really water sensitive. They're not outright soluble at regular temperatures, pressures, and acidities. But they certainly can be, they can lose their sparkle, so to speak, in water. But you can use indirect methods of applying them. There's a great book that came out some years ago called How to Make Sacred Water or How to Create Sacred Water. It's published by Bear and Company. And the author of that book goes into great length describing how she used a selenite wand to make the sacred water. And over time, the wand got smaller and smaller and smaller. This mm-hmm. was over the passage of years, but mm-hmm. it did in fact come apart in her, wow. in her sacred water.
Wow. We don't think about that. Stones are indestructible, aren't they, right?
I mean, sometimes.
They're hard things. They don't melt. But no, it's not true. We look at it in a different way. And it's also interesting, Patsy in chat says she cleanses her stones by holding the stone in her hands, closing her eyes, and see her hands and the stone as pure white. That sounds good.
Yeah, one of the very first cleansing techniques that I learned was from this weird and wonderful little teeny book called The Crystal Book, appropriately enough. And it was first published in the late 1970s by Dale Walker. And his preferred method for cleansing, once you were really in tune with a crystal, was visualization. Mm-hmm. You know, the caveat here is that you had to be in tune with the crystal. You had to somehow be synced up with it enough to be able to sense its needs and to do it honestly. I think there's a real fine line between perception of something and the projection from our ego. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he goes to great lengths to teach you how to be more attuned to your crystals and to do that. But I actually still use some of those techniques that I learned from books like his and some of the very first crystal books that were out on the market in my everyday practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's just so much to learn here. And That's why we have you.
Cool.
There's just so many different things to talk about. There's a question, another question from the chat room from Tabby. She said, is there anything special that you should keep your crystals in? She says she keeps hers wrapped in silk.
And I bet your crystals love that. You know, early on, I learned that we should store our crystals away from other people in a natural fiber cloth, preferably in some sort of sacred and safe place. And I think that's really wonderful if you have a handful that you're using on a very regular basis. But my collection is, we'll say, a little bit too large for that. And if I had one piece of silk for every one of those stones, I don't know how many silkworms I would be responsible for. So, you know, these days I'm a big fan of using plastic containers that you get from the craft store. And I know plastic is not the most mystical of materials out there, but it is rather insulating. One, it's got a little bit more give than something like metal or glass or other things. So my crystals are slightly more cushioned in that than they would be in something else. But also it has kind of an insulating effect energetically. So I can kind of dampen the vibes of putting out in the general room. So it's less background noise, so to speak, energetically.
Mm, okay. Because, see, I've got rocks all over my house and crystals and stuff. Now, some of them, the polished ones, I've got on the ancestor altar in a nice little jar, or not a jar, in a stone dish. And I does that take away? I mean, they're kind of out in the open, but not in the open, but they're all together, and all the polished ones are together. You know, it's like one happy little family in there on the altar. Does that diminish anything if they're not wrapped or cared for or whatever?
No, I really don't think so. I think ultimately we have to do what is practical and sensible for us. I have lots of stones that are all over the place. And, you know, I think the idea of wrapping them individually in a sacred cloth and keeping them, you know, out of sight, out of mind is one, a product of the era when mm-hmm. it was much less mainstream to do this woo-woo kind of stuff. But also like a sign of respect and dedication to your spiritual practice. Crystals mm-hmm. were a lot harder to get. People generally didn't have the kinds and sizes of collections that we have today. There are lots of practical things that kind of delineate that. Mm-hmm. I think if those approaches work for you, absolutely do them. But I've seen many a beautiful dish full of stones on an altar, on an end table, on a coffee table, out mm-hmm. and about in the sort of everyday space. And, you know, that's a really valid way of working too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the only stones that I have in any kind of wrapper are the ones that I keep with my tarot deck and my oracle deck. I always put a quartz stone in with them just to help the decks get stronger and the quartz is happy. It has a job to do, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So, yeah. Okay, I was just interested because a lot of people do put them away or keep them in boxes or whatever. And mine seem to be very happy on the altar. So, good. Thank you. Yeah. All right. Now, we're just talking about polished stones. And Cece was wondering, and another question that you submitted from your group came in about the same thing. She's wondering about the use of tumbled stones instead of natural raw stones. And the question that you came with were, are also rough stones better than polished? Is there a difference in their energy? And why are tumbled stones more common now?
Oh, there's a lot of layers there.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's start with why are they so common now? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, supply and demand, the market supplies what the consumers demand. People love the look and the feel of tumbled stones. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of stones, like if you have a really rough, unpolished piece of labradorite, you are less likely to appreciate that beautiful labradorescence, that beautiful shine that it has within it, that iridescent play of color. Same with, you know, a rough opal versus a polished one. If mm-hmm. a lot of people saw a gem quality diamond straight out of the earth, they would not recognize it as a diamond until it has that sort of inner beauty revealed through the process of cutting and polishing. So in a practical sense, we can appreciate the beauty of things better when they're prepared. You know, as mm-hmm. far as is one better than the other, on a fundamental level, the factors that are responsible for a crystal's energy are things like its formation process, what geological process brought it to life in the earth, what are its ingredients, what's its chemical composition, its chemical formula, and what kind of crystal structure does it have? And this is a molecular kind of structure, not an external one. Mm-hmm. So no amount of rubbing, cutting, grinding, crushing, scraping, polishing, or otherwise influencing the superficial level of stone, the outside, changes any of those factors. So, you know, if all other qualities are equal, then as far as rough versus tumbled, we really don't have much of a difference in their energy at all. Now, there's one thing that shape can do to a stone, and it might affect the way the energy is distributed, but it doesn't change what the energy is. So, you know, if you have a long, thin wand of something versus a sphere, that long, thin wand with a single point is very directional in its energy flow, mm-hmm. whereas a sphere is going to softly radiate energy in all directions simultaneously. And one other little note I'd love to throw out there is when people see rough stones in the store and they think, oh, they're so much more natural. By the time you pick up a rough piece of anything in your local metaphysical store or rock shop, It has been so thoroughly processed. It has probably been blasted out of the earth. It has been soaked in some sort of acid to clean off the grime. It has been hand scrubbed. It has been carted all the way around the world. It's gone through other machines that crush it down to smaller sizes in many cases, especially if they're not, you know, crystal points. The only steps that it's missing between being, you know, a raw piece of something in a, you know, polished stone, or that it hasn't gone into a rock tumbler and been polished. They've both gone through an immense amount of processing. So this idea that rough stones are somehow in a more natural state than polished stones mm-hmm. is also kind of a false economy, because we can't see what really goes on in the mining and mineral prepping process.
That's a good thing. I never thought about that, but it certainly makes sense. All right. Another question from the chat room. She says she was on vacation with her grandchildren when they were very young, and one of them picked up a small, odd-shaped rock and gave it to her. And she says she's got to admit that she gets energy off of it all the time. Is that possible with a regular, ordinary rock?
Absolutely. You know, one of my favorite stones to just kind of work with for healing or other things is granite. Granite is just ordinary rock. You know, if I'm out in a public space and I see a granite countertop, I'm one, being a geology nerd and trying to identify all the minerals that are in it, and two, I'm interfacing with its energy in some intentional way, even if it's in a very subtle sense. And you know, granite is potent stuff. The rocks and minerals we find at the roadside, in parking lots, in gravel driveways, at the lakeside, on the beach, in the mountains, they're all part and parcel of the body of Mother Earth, and no single one of those is somehow more sacred than any other. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like Mother Earth trying to pick the favorite cell in her body. I can't even differentiate one cell in my body from the next on a conscious level. So how could I possibly pick my favorite?
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Another chat room question. How would aragonite affect the nature of the stone it is in?
So I will admit I'm not super well versed in all of the sort of theory and practice behind aragonite. You know, I have a kind of cursory working knowledge of it, and it's, you know, originally was supposed to be quartz, resin, and metal shavings. And nowadays we have beautiful aragonites that are made out of things that are not necessarily limited to quartz. And the goal behind them is to generate what is called orgone, another word for life force. And, you know, the specifics of how those mechanics work are not something an avid student of will say. Mm-hmm. My practical experience with aragonite is I think it is very good for shielding against, we'll say, harmful electromagnetic energies. Things mm-hmm. that come from our devices or from harmful features around us, whether it's, you know, an electrical transformer or, you know, ley lines that intersect right under your bed and keep you up all night, or draining human beings in your environment even. Those can be sources of energetic pollution too. But generally, I find aragonite is not great for broadcasting the energy of a particular crystal in the environment. So if you have one that's filled with all these beautiful gemstones, of course it's doing something beautiful, but it's not quite the same thing as just having those gems in your collection arranged in the same kind of pattern. And I can't quite put my finger on why, but I think it has to do with the mechanics of what orgone is and does.
Okay. Age-old question. Does the size of a crystal matter?
You know, I read so many very polite ways that people address this question, saying that, you know, ultimately size doesn't matter. But, you know, if you have a teeny tiny little watch battery versus a car battery, they have two very different voltages in them, don't they? Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with our crystals. If every other parameter is the same, so if they're the same shape, if they are the same dimensions, if, you know, the same kind of proportions, if you will, the same quality and color saturation, they're, you know, have the same kinds of inclusions, everything else is equal, then the bigger a crystal is, the louder its volume, or the farther its signal will stretch and still be detectable. Louder is not better. Louder is just louder. There are some things you can accomplish in a whisper, and there are other things you have to shout at the top of your lungs to be heard at. So, you know, think of it that way. A lot of people will kind of compare apples to oranges and say that size doesn't matter because you can have a 2 gram piece of moldavite and it will kick your butt versus, you know, a size of, say, black tourmaline that's the size of a grapefruit. But, you know, we're not comparing the same thing. You can have that 2 gram piece of moldavite in one hand and a moldavite the size of a grapefruit in the other. And guess which one's going to kick your butt more? The big one. Mm-hmm. So we have to remember that there are lots of factors that go into crystal energy, but mass is an important part of understanding the frequency of the stone. There's also a relationship between frequency and size. The, you know, if we look at a violin string or a guitar string, if we have one that's 1 foot long and then one that's 2 feet long, the one that's 2 feet long has a lower frequency. It's a lower pitch, a lower note on the scale. One that's half the length is double the frequency. It's something that we perceive as a higher pitch. And the same is true with our crystals. Smaller ones have a higher frequency. Bigger ones have a low frequency. And neither is better than the other. You know, we have this misconception that high frequency equals good and low frequency equals bad. But when we raise our consciousness, the frequency of our brainwaves actually decreases. It goes down. It lowers. And that's just the nature of our brain.
Okay. Patsy in chat says, I have some fairly large stones. It's okay to manually break them to share, right?
I suppose it depends on the nature of what it is you're breaking. You know, all the kind of fibrous satin spar selenite that we see on the market gets sawed out of great big blocks into much smaller pieces. So, you know, all the tumbled stones, for the most part, we buy in stores have been broken down from much larger bits into much smaller bits. So, you know, in a hypothetical sense, of course, you can break any rock down. But, you know, if it's something that's in our collection, maybe check in with your stone before you do it. I have certainly had to, multiply inventory, if you catch my drift, by breaking stones into smaller pieces for projects. So that is a possibility. But, you know, check in with your stones. Make sure they are okay with that. And chances are they probably will be. And if you feel any strong resistance, just double check and see if it isn't your own projection of, you know, that reticence about breaking up a beautiful rock into something smaller.
Mm-hmm. And Kat just countered that. She said, well, every stone was once a part of a bigger one for the most part. So,
yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right. Tina, she says she's a lover of moldavite, and her understanding is that they can help with contact with the alien lives. Are you any thoughts on that? Moldavite and UF aliens?
Yeah. I mean, certainly that's what the people say. I've been a lover of moldavite since I was, we'll say, much smaller than I am today. I got my first piece quite a long time ago, and I've never had any extraterrestrial contact with that. But to be fair, I've never had any extraterrestrial contact or any inclination toward it in any other part of my life as well. So I think because it is something that raises our consciousness up, that, you know, has this sort of relationship with a stellar or sidereal or astral energy, that we might be able to do that. But I think that it is a really wonderful stone in a whole lot of ways, but so are a lot of other crystals. I remember reading in Melody's Love is in the Earth that apatite was a stone that assisted with extraterrestrial communication. And so I never had any success with that either. So it really comes down to what our subjective personal experience, what we might call our unverified personal gnosis is. And, you know, when we have those experiences, we sit with them and we allow them to be without attachment or judgment, and then we try to unravel them. And I think a lot of people do have success kind of contacting a force outside of our everyday life, whether we call that ETs or star beings or angels or fairies. That's going to look different depending on your spiritual path.
It's true. And, you know, when you were talking, since quartz is such a great transmitter and receiver, you would think that would kind of draw in aliens or whoever you're trying to get in touch with as well, because it's known for that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there was a time when radio technology was all all based on crystals, especially quartz and galena. I think there are lots of people who've had ET experiences with just good old-fashioned quartz, too.
Yeah. I mean, I know that they have, each stone has properties, and they're used for different things. And I think there might be a question down here later that I'm overlooking right now, just about that. I mean, certain stones are meant to do certain things, but perhaps if you put enough intention into a stone, if you resonate with that stone, it might be able to do whatever bidding you need, aside from what it's known for. Is that fair?
Yeah, you know, think of it as like, in witchcraft, the familiar spirit idea, whether that's a plant spirit or a stone spirit, mm-hmm. it might have a predisposition, a set of skills that it's especially good at. But then if you really build a relationship with that, they might be willing to go outside their comfort zone and do more for you than what the books say they do. But a lot of that's predicated on what we bring to the table and what we're willing to do in partnership with them.
Okay, that makes sense. All right, a half hour has gone really quickly, so we are going to take a quick break. I know, huh? And so everybody stay put, you know, go talk to your stones or whatever in 2 minutes, and we'll be right back.
Stirring the Cauldron will be right back, so don't go away.
If you end up with webbed feet,
remember, you've been warned.
Explore the second edition of the Witch's Oracle Deck through 45 innovative cards and enhanced guidebook that peers into the world of the witch. The deck's stunning artwork has a new look and includes 7 brand new inspirational cards. Each card now includes a suggested crystal or gemstone to enhance your reading, as well as a magical incantation that provides energy, reinforces the card's meaning, and helps the desired message to be sent out into the universe. The easy-to-navigate guide also has a new look and offers straightforward, gentle guidance that takes readers through both good times and bad. And now includes a chapter on crystal and gemstone divination by the amazing Nicholas Pearson. The Witch's Oracle. It is a perfect divination deck for witches as well as non-pagans, and is designed to suit both seasoned readers and beginners alike. Find out more about the Witch's Oracle deck at www.marlabrooks.com, and you can purchase the deck from schifferbooks.com, amazon.com, or order a copy from your favorite bookseller.
You've no doubt heard of Tango and Cash, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, perhaps It Takes Two to Tango. Well now, on the first and third Thursdays of each month, there's a show called Tango and Friends at 8 p.m. Eastern on the Para-X Radio Network with your host, Bruce Tango. And yes, there will be at least two to tango on each episode, sometimes even more. There's going to be lots of topics and lots of guests you'll all know and lots of surprises. Tango and Friends, every first and third Thursday of the month at 8 p.m. right here on the Para-X Radio Network.
Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Welcome back, and in case you've tuned in late, my guest is Nicholas Pearson, and tonight he's answering all kinds of questions about stones and crystals. And before the break, some more questions came in from the chat room, and I know you talked to somebody, Nicholas, in chat about it, but I think we'll share it with the rest of the world, too. Kat was talking about obsidian, and what properties does it have? She said she found a piece that looks as if it was once part of a large man-made object, and one side is polished and nearly flat. So you gave her a good answer about obsidian, and let's share it.
Sure. Obsidian is one of my most trusted crystal allies, although it's not a proper crystal in the materials science sense of the world. Obsidian is a stone that really reflects what is underpinning any given situation. Think of it as a mirror that has no filter, a really honest friend who's just going to call you on your stuff as they see it, with no personal bias and no agenda involved. Another gift of obsidian is when we have that gift of perspective, we can really learn how we want to invest our time, our energy, our intention, our inclination in the world. So it's going to help us hone the mind to cut through the stuff of the world, so we can really get to the point. It is also a really powerful ally that is protective, that is initiatory, that is a deeply shamanic kind of stone. So, you know, we could probably do a whole hour just on obsidian, as much as I love it and all the different varieties that there are. But, you know, a great place to learn more about obsidian is in chapter one of my first book, The Seven Archetypal Stones, Their Spiritual Powers and Teachings.
And I'm partial to obsidian now because that's the first time that you and I ever kind of spoke off the air, because yeah. I had this huge stone that I had no clue. I thought it was a big hunk of tar or something because it was shiny. And I really was kind of ashamed to even bother you with it. You know, it took me a while to just say, okay, I got to find out about this stone. But yeah, so obsidian brought us together in a sense. So I'm very happy about obsidian in that respect too. All right. Got another question. Tabby says that she has a large piece of white quartz that she dug from around the roots of a huge fallen tree. She says, why don't I feel right about washing the dirt from it?
You know, I would say the stone itself is going to give you a better answer than I will. So I would kind of tune in and sense that. But, you know, again, I want to bring back my old favorite argument of perception versus projection. You know, get into a really neutral and centered still space in your heart mind before you engage with that. So that way it's really the stone talking and not your ego. I have had many a great conversation with my ego masquerading as the intelligence of a stone in my teen years. You know, see what the stone has to say about that. Sometimes it's our attachment. Sometimes there's really a blessing that the stone is willing to share.
Yeah, and I like that you're talking about interacting with the stones and not just thinking of them as just chunks of hard things sitting around, you know. I mean, they have spirit. They have, they're not somebody that's going to get up and talk to you, but you get energy. You give and get energy from there. You can sort of have conversations with stones, yes?
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
I think it's important. Absolutely. Bella is wondering, what do you consider a happy stone, one that attracts happiness? Is Herkimer diamonds considered a happy stone?
You know, I think if a stone brings you joy, it is a stone of happiness. This is a really kind of subjective situation. I think that you won't find... I would be hard-pressed to define any particular stone as attracting happiness. However, I might say that there are stones that can help us confront our baggage of what stands in the way of realizing self-actualization, what stands in the way of happiness. There might be stones that encourage us to seek out a more positive perspective, but I don't think any stone can make us or attract to us anything in particular unless we're also willing to do the work. So, you know, Herkimer diamonds being a form of quartz, quartz is an all-purpose stone. We can definitely imbue it with that intention or charge or program it to help us on that road to happiness. A stone that I really associate with peace and harmony and, you know, by extension, eventually we get to that point of happiness through those same words is jade. Jade helps us kind of empty ourselves out of the things that stand in the way of peace. And if you aren't carrying the unpeaceful bits around in your psyche anymore, well, guess what? You become filled with the peace of the universe. And that's a pretty happy state to be in. So mm-hmm. That's another great one, too.
Sounds good. All right. Another question. Can you recommend stones for a caregiver?
You know, for sure. I think, again, this is a situation where it is hard to give a specific recommendation without knowing the specifics of a situation. But I can share some wisdom that I've learned from some of my teachers. So mm-hmm. Jane Ann Dow, who was the author of a sadly now out of print book called Crystal Journey. You know, she talked about the caregiver personality and made some recommendations of stones that were in there, as did some of my other teachers. And I have always found that mangano calcite is a good stone for someone who's in that sort of caregiver role. And mm-hmm. it's a stone that reminds us we can't pour from the empty vessel. So does it magically make us an amazing, wonderful, healthy caregiver with all the energy to go in the world? No. But it reminds us when we have to take a step back and focus on us. So that could be a great one. I also think rhodonite is a really wonderful stone for anyone who's in that caregiver situation, because oftentimes we're responsible not only for our own emotional and physical well-being, but for the emotional and physical well-being of others. So rhodonite helps us maintain an even keel emotionally. And if we drop that emotional anchor well enough, then we kind of radiate that sense of calm and peace, even during pretty turbulent times, to the benefit of others. And that sense of calm can be kind of contagious, and it's a really great thing.
Of all the things that are contagious, calm is the best one, I think.
Ain't it the truth these days?
Yeah. Uh-huh. All right, another question. How do crystals protect you? What are the best stones for protection?
Well, you know, kind of like with the other situations, I'm going to say there's no singular best stone for everybody. Mm-hmm. In a broad sense, you know, the first part of the question is, how do crystals protect you? In most cases, it is not because they build some sort of energetic barrier, at least not unless you're consciously directing them to, and there's some great ways to do that. Mm-hmm. When we look at the human energy field, it exists in a state of incoherence, which means that it is not super well organized in terms of physics. So I'm certainly not calling anyone who's listening incoherent in any way other than in the sense of electromagnetics. But, you know, that's the nature of life. We're in a state of flux. We change. The frequency and amplitude of our liver is different than our lungs and our kidneys and our big toes and our pinkies, because they all have different makeups and different functions. So we're supposed to have an incoherent energy field, at least to a certain extent. When we bring something that is highly ordered, like any crystalline substance, any rock or mineral, into our energy field, it entrains us to be a little bit more coherent. As we raise the coherency of our field, we also raise the amplitude, the volume, or the strength of it. So it requires something much louder than whatever we're turning into to offset that balance. So at least on one level or another, any sort of crystal is protective because it engenders that sense of crystalline order and integrity to the energy field. And it makes us less susceptible to outside substances or people or places or feelings that are less ordered and less coherent than that crystalline state. There are some stones that I think are certainly better attuned to this than others. But it's going to depend on the kind of protection that you need. So one of my favorites to recommend, and one that I wear most days when I leave the house for protection, is labradorite. Labradorite mm-hmm. is a stone that helps our light shine without dimming us. Think of it almost like a layer of Teflon for the aura. So that way we can still show up for things, but they don't cling to us. It allows you to be open and empathetic without being overly empathic and taking things on that don't belong to you. So it is a brilliant stone. I also love working with Praseli Bluestone for protection. This is the very ancient stone that comes from the Praseli Hills in Wales that was used, among other things, to create the inner ring of stones at Stonehenge. And Praseli Bluestone is really deeply nourishing. Its composition and even like the sort of formula of its colors has been analyzed to show that this particular stone affects us at the deepest level of our identity, the deepest level of our physical body as well. And it brings this sense of nourishing and healing and order. And so that's really deeply grounding and transformational. So that's a really great protection stone that I work with. And these days, because of the nature of the world, I think an uncommon one that we could recommend is Arfvedsonite. Arfvedsonite is the stone for chaos, for the dark night of the soul, for just abject terror and uncertainty. And what it does, it helps replace fear with curiosity. So instead of being fearful of what might come to pass, which puts us in a very vulnerable and weakened state, energetically speaking, as well as emotionally and socially too, what it offers us is a chance to explore the unknown without losing power to a fear of the unknown. And that makes a very different kind of protection that is so magical.
Wow.
And I'll spell that one out in the chat room since it's a funny word.
Yeah. And I'll suggest that people get it. Oh, that's an interesting. Okay. And for those that are going to be listening on podcast, it's spelled ARFVEDSONITE. I've never heard of that. Well, I haven't heard of a lot of them, but that, okay. That's really a good hint because we need this now. I mean, you know, as much as, well, more than ever usually. All right. Another question. Do man-made stones work as well as natural ones?
Oh, this is a great one. Yes and no. First, what kind of man-made stone are we talking about? Is it something that is lab-created and chemically identical to what we'd find out in the wild, so to speak? You know, for example, a lab-created ruby. A lab-created ruby is the same mineral, corundum, that a natural ruby is. It gets its color from the same tiny little bit of chromium, which makes it red. It has the same crystal structure, the same specific gravity. There'll be lots of things that kind of signify it didn't come from the earth. If you're a highly trained specialist, you'll be able to identify those things. But if you're just looking at two rubies side by side with the naked eye, they're more or less identical. So it's going to have the same factors, more or less, that produce the same kind of qualities in the electromagnetic field that surrounds it. But there's a difference. And the difference I found with lab-created crystals is that it's like having a beautiful stained glass window with no light behind it. There's just something that is missing. And that something is the spark of consciousness that a crystal develops as it forms in the womb of Mother Earth. Now, other man-made stones that are out there aren't really stones at all. Things like opalite and then our brightly colored obsidians. There is no brilliant emerald green or cobalt blue or aqua or yellow or red or purple obsidian. It's all glass. It's the same magical substance that protects you when you are sitting behind your windshield in the car. but it is, you know, fundamentally the same thing with a few trace elements thrown in to change the color. So glass has been used in magic for a long time. But glass is non-crystalline, and although there are natural glasses, they have a different kind of long-range and short-range order and a different mineralized makeup than most man-made glasses do. So they have a different set of properties, and those sorts of things aren't the kinds of things that generally find their way into my practice, but they're beautiful, and I often have a few around just because I like their beauty.
Yeah, that's a good enough reason for sure. Kathy says she has a small amethyst stone, and sometimes when she holds it in her hand, it gets very, very hot, and she has to put it down because it gets too hot. What would cause that, or is it just her?
Well, you know, I think it's not just her, and it's not just the stone. It is the relationship that Kathy has with her amethyst that causes that. So when we feel a crystal heat up, maybe we feel it pulse or tingle, or we feel some sort of magnetic flow of energy that we can't otherwise put into words. That is a conversation taking place between the human energy field and the crystal energy field. The nature of that conversation is personal. It is, you know, relational. It's the additive effect of your energy and their energy coming together. So I can't tell you what is being said, but here's the good news. You can tell us what's being said if you feel like sharing. All you have to do is kind of tune in. And if ever it becomes uncomfortable, you know, always two things to think of. One, cleanse your crystal. Ask yourself, when was the last time I cleansed it? If it wasn't today or yesterday, probably cleanse it now. And two, you know, invite your crystal to come in or approach you with an energy that is more accessible to you. And a lot of times crystals will honor that and they'll kind of meet you halfway.
Okay. We're going down the list really well. Another question. Can you talk a little bit about ethically sourced stones?
For sure. With the time we have remaining, we're definitely not going to get too far into this. But, you know, this is a conversation that is happening more and more. And I'm absolutely delighted and humbled that people are asking the hard questions. Where do these stones come from? How do we get them? Who is responsible for taking them out of the earth and under what circumstances? And, you know, there are lots of times when the answers to all of those questions is, I don't know. If you ask your local, you know, owner of a crystal shop where a crystal came from, and you know the answer is probably going to be from a wholesale person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you ask that wholesale person where they got it, the answer is probably, well, I got it at a big trade show. If you ask the person at the big trade show where they got it, then maybe you start to get specific answers. Not everyone is really concerned with those areas of the market, but more and more people are asking those questions. Now, the funny thing is, in the mineral science side of the world, provenance is everything. The difference in price between two minerals that look almost identical but come from two different places can be the difference of a couple of zeros in price sometimes, just because of the historic nature of a mine. So, you know, provenance is something that's out there. And, you know, when it comes to ethically sourced minerals, of course, there are horrible mining practices out there that put the market value of an inert substance that is taken from the geosphere well above the value of a human life. Mm. I'm not going to sugarcoat that. That is absolutely happening. The great news is that is mostly happening for things like jewelry, diamonds, and other precious substances, as well as the minerals and ores that are used to create our technology. I mean, I'm communicating with you on an iPhone. The labor that's involved in getting the cobalt and the other metals that are involved in the making of this are far worse than anything that can happen bringing amethyst to the market. And that is sad. I mean, I said it was a great thing, but it's really not. But we have to remember that if we're having this kind of conversation via our technology, maybe we should start by having the conversation about ethical mining practices, about our technology. A lot of the stones that we get on the crystal healing market are actually byproducts of mining much more economically viable and valuable things. And those are what are called the gang minerals or the tailings or the stuff that is just kind of a surplus to the really valuable metal or other substance that's being extracted from the earth. So there is hope. There's a greater number of wholesalers and retailers who are striving to buy ethically, which means that it's popping up in more of our stores. And even our stores who aren't asking those kinds of questions, whose consumers aren't asking those kinds of questions, enough change is happening on the market that things are turning around anyway. And there are vendors that I know whose dollars go directly to the miners themselves. There's no great big middleman or long chain of middle people that takes us there. And I was recently chatting with a friend who does business in Africa, and he says year after year when he goes back to these areas in Mali and Tanzania and other places, he sees the difference his money makes. People have better clothes. People's homes are in better states of repair. People are better fed. And you would think, coming from a privileged nation in the West, that you know these are things that we take for granted. We don't have to stop and go, well, if I buy this rock, does it put money in someone's pocket or does it go to corporate America? But you know. Mm-hmm. Those are real conversations that need to be had, but they're being had. So, thank you for asking.
Yeah, good question. Here's one that I'm curious about because I really never gave it much thought. Is there ever a time when crystals can cause harm instead of healing?
It's not the kind of thing that I talk about very often. If you look at the evidence in crystal healing literature, going back very, very far, yes, crystals have been known to cause harm. In a very practical sense, anyone who's dropped a geode on their foot is going to tell you crystals can cause harm. Anyone who's gone digging for rocks in Arkansas will tell you that quartz crystal cuts to the bone if you're not wearing gloves. But in a metaphysical sense, if we don't know what we're doing, if we are trying to do too much, too soon, too fast, then yeah, we can get uncomfortable. And it's not the kind of discomfort that I like to encourage people to have, that's just, you know, flexing new muscles and experiencing new energies. It is entirely possible that some crystals just aren't right for some people. So we have to be mindful of that. And I think that's why it's really good to be well educated. I think that's why looking up memes that tell you what crystals to go in what chakras may not be the most helpful advice. If we aren't effectively cleansing our crystals, there are certainly cases where we can be, transferring energy from person to person that doesn't need to be there. And one of my mentors that I respect quite a lot in the world of gem therapy has even talked about the damage that certain forms of diamonds had done to students and clients of hers in the 1980s. And she could see this damage being done to people's auras. So, we want to do all things mindfully. Mm-hmm. And I think it's great that we have so many tools at our disposal, but we should, you know, we should endeavor to be intelligent about how we use them.
Yeah. And, you know, I kind of think that when you hold a crystal, you can feel whether it's right for you or not. And I mean, not that if you hold one, it's going to burn a hole in the palm of your hand or something, but if you listen to it, if you feel it, if you let your intuition take over, you'll know that this is a good crystal for you or not so good crystal. I mean, it's not going to come and smack you in the head in the middle of the night because you put it down. But I think we have to listen to the intuition and the feeling that we get when we hold one. And that's the best way to try it out, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. We've got like 2 minutes, and I want you to just tell everybody really quickly where they can find your books, because there's so many books that cover so many beautiful crystal things and stuff, and if we mention them all, we'll be here another half hour, which is a good thing. But so where can people find out about the books and where they can get them?
You can definitely find my books anywhere that books are sold. Visit your local metaphysical retailer. Hop onto Amazon.com. Go visit my publisher at innertraditions.com, and you can buy copies there. My most recent book, which is my all-in-one, everything you need to know to get started and then go a heck of a lot farther, is called Crystal Basics, The Energetic Healing and Spiritual Power of 200 Gemstones. That just came out earlier this year, and that's going to be a really good all-in-one resource.
Okay. And you've got to come back, because see, we were worried we might not get enough questions to fill an hour or two, but I think we actually can. But so you're working really, really quickly. You're working on a new book right now, yes?
I am. I'm working on a new book on flower essences. It's going to be in my publisher's hands in the next few weeks. Come heck or high water, I'm going to do it. And then I've got a couple more projects planned after that. The one I'm working on now is not crystal related, but the one after that will be. That much I can tell you. I have a few irons in the fire at any moment, and I'm really excited about some of my upcoming work.
Yes, and also, speaking of not crystals, you have a wonderful book on Reiki. So
yes,
for people that are interested in that, he's not a one-trick pony, guys. He's got a lot going for him. So I really want to thank you for doing this, because like we said earlier, it was, you know, you're the guinea pig and see if it works. And obviously it does. So thank you for you know, putting yourself up there and brave and handling it.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much for having me. And thanks for all the great questions, everyone.
Yes. Thank you for everybody who asked and who sent them in. It's really, really important. And thank you for everybody who's listening in as well. Really appreciate it. And we do, like I think I mentioned before, maybe I didn't, we've got another Q&A show coming up next month with psychic and spiritual healer Echo Bodine, because she's another one like Nicholas that runs out of time really fast. So she'll be talking, you can ask questions about spirits in general and life on the other side. And in the meantime, until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Please join us again next week at the same time for another great guest and more cauldron stirring. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited.